I'm pleased this morning to introduce Ivy Kennedy Hall as our speaker. Ivy is from the George Gordon First Nation, about 125 kilometers northeast of Regina, and she's lived in Regina most of her life, but at one time she worked in Calgary. There, she says, she was shocked by the number of First Nations women sleeping on the street with no place to go. And sadly, we have many people sleeping on our streets here as well. Hopefully not this morning. Upon her return to Regina in 1993, she was one of the founders of Women of the Dawn, a grassroots nonprofit organization which she established to meet the need to work with other urban First Nations women in the mutual pursuit of self-reliance and social and economic self-sufficiency. Really just amazing goals. Ivy's a member of the board of directors of Women of the Dawn, and I'm really looking forward to hearing her speak about it this morning.
Thank you. Good morning, and can you hear me? Okay, thank you. When I came in here this morning, and before I even came in here, I looked at your church and I thought, what a beautiful church. And the snow was there and it looked so beautiful. And I didn't have a theme, to announce this morning or to follow. And my husband asked me, well, do you have anything prepared? I said, no, because I should know now what I've been doing all my life and where I've worked and things like that. But I was really touched by that number 560, where it says there how people say, what is the sense of our small effort? And sometimes we go about in our lives and we think, what are we doing to make an impact in other people's lives? And I want to make an impact for people, for God. Now, I was raised on the George Gordon First Nation in 1953 to 1958. I didn't know anything about God or anything like that. Our culture was to do the medicines and the sweet grass and all this, ceremonies, and I didn't understand them. But I would go out into the playground on a reservation and I would see all these different cloths hanging in the trees, and I didn't understand it. So I didn't really know anything about God at all. Nothing. But I went into the residential school for 3 years. We had a very traumatic experience in our lives. We had used to use horses and wagons and go to the cities, to Punichai and to Regina on horseback and things like that. One night, my whole family was driving in a wagon and horses to go back to the reservation, and a truck came over the hill and killed my grandfather, my brother, and hurt many of my family and in 1961, and then from there, I moved to Regina because my mother thought, well, it's better to take her off the reservation and not leave her there. So, which was good, because then I came to Regina, and at that time, in 1961, there was hardly any First Nations people in our city. And so I was put into a school, and there was all non-Aboriginal people, and I was this little Indian girl there, and I thought, oh my God. Where am I? Because I had culture shock. And then I thought to myself, I have to, we had exam time and I had the same kind of marks as other students. I said, okay, I'm just as smart as they are. So I start to settle into the urban area. Throughout the life, I became to an age of maybe grade 12 years old and grade 9. And I was pretty smart at that time, and I thought I was. Was in Marion High School, and you had to be very strict, right? You had to wear uniforms, and I wanted to help people at that time. I wanted to have children in their own homes. So I remember saying, I want to help people at that time. And then I went through my life and didn't finish high school, got married at a young age, and then returned back to school, had my children. And then I began to work in the community at the age of 25. And then that's where my service began. I worked as an executive director for a First Nations women's organization. And at the same time, I lived in a sort of like a middle class environment where I didn't see a lot of alcoholics, drug addicts, or anything like that. Nothing at all. Didn't understand the disease. Didn't understand the homelessness. Didn't understand poverty, like the hunger, because we didn't have no needs for those kinds of things, because we were doing quite well. And then I had a traumatic experience in my life. I got divorced after 17 years of marriage, and then went on my way. But I had something in my heart where I had dreams when I was growing up, and I used to dream all the time, daydream, and I remember all of a sudden I started getting these visions in my night and prophetic dreams about people, about their lives. I couldn't understand what these dreams were, but in our culture, there was a gift that was given to our medicine people, and there were visions and dreams, and they told you about the future. So I started having dreams, and I had this vision of an earthquake, just traumatic earthquake, and all of a sudden, my whole life changed, and now I'm in Calgary. Because now first I'd worked at the women's organization, began to know about the Native women plight and how the poverty and all the issues, but not yet really realizing them myself. So now I'm in Calgary, and I started working on the streets of Skid Row, working as an Aboriginal educator, working in the downtown bars, sitting in the bars, playing pool with the clients. My job was to educate them about HIV. Now all the girls would come in, sit down at my table, and I started educating them about HIV, the rampant, increase of the HIV. And then I began to realize that a lot of these women had drug abuse. They were abused as children. And I remember this one girl, she was sitting in a bar, and she was like crying, and it was really dark in the Cecil Hotel in Calgary, the worst bar you can sit in. It was dark in there. So I went up to this lady and I said, "Can I sit with you?" And she said, "Sure." And she was crying. I said, "Are you okay?" And she said, "No." She said, "I want to commit suicide." I said, "Why do you want to commit suicide?" I was trying to make conversation with her, and my job wasn't to be there to help her. My job was to educate, but at the same time, I was doing service, in my life. And then she said, "No one loves me." So instantly I thought, oh my God, I got a suicidal client. Either I run back to my seat over there, or I try to, see if I can help the young lady. And she had committed two murders, and she was about 35, something like that. She was raped at the age of 4. And then from there she had went and committed two murders. She was in for, 8 years, and really rough life. So I said to her, I said, "Someone loves you." And she said, "Who's that?" And I said, "Well, God." Because I had to tell this lady that there was some hope for her, and there is hope. So anyway, she went and came out of the hotel, and I said, "Come to my office at 9 o'clock in the morning and I'll help you." So she came at 9, I took her to treatment. 6 months later, I happened to be working on the street again, went into this downtown ministry, sat there for a moment, and here she was, and she was saying she had recovered, and that this lady had told her from CUPS, it's called Calgary Urban Project Society, that someone had loved her, and that she was continuing her walk. So that's sometimes I wonder, what our life and our ministry is. But he eventually shows us what we have to do. So I have that gift of helping people. Sometimes my husband says, "What are you doing? You're always helping those people. They have no goals. They don't want to go to work. Tell them to go to work." I said, "Oh my God, But anyway, he's starting to understand, because he said, "I'm not giving you no dollar out of my pocket to give to those people." But he also has a kind heart. I've met my soulmate. I met him in Jamaica on holidays, and I didn't realize I was going to go through a bad time in my life again. Like, you think your life is going straight, but then you fall, and then you get back up, and you go, and then, I've had some very interesting times, but I met my soulmate. He's very stubborn, more stubborn than I am, so that's why he's my soulmate till life. And so through my life, I've seen the conditions of Aboriginal people and people, not just Aboriginal people, because I worked at the correctional center. I locked up guys in there. 90% of them have alcohol and drugs until they decide to do something about their alcoholism and drugs. We can't help them. They need programs, they need a lot of help. And I can't just wipe them off and say, well, you know, we have to discard them. They're not, you know, they're not useful. But until they find themselves and say, I don't want to drink anymore, and reach out, then that's the beginning for them. So after working with the women's organization, working with the men in the correctional center, going from the schedule, and then working on schedule, I thought, oh my God, there's got to be so much more than this. Why are there so many people hurting? Why are people dying every day? Why is there homelessness? Because I was driving people to the highway, women with children to the highway, back to Saskatchewan. Because now in 1990, there was no welfare system in BC. There is, but you have to live there for 3 months before you get onto welfare. That's 1990. And in Manitoba, same thing. So Saskatchewan, we still had NDP government at that time, so they were able to still get assistance here immediately. So they'd be hitchhiking back to Saskatchewan. So I thought in my life, well, I need to know why there's so much hurting and much pain. You know, why are these people, why are we, you know, why is there so much hurting people? And I met this Catholic nun, and she had this Aboriginal woman. She was dying of alcoholism, and she died in her arms, but she said to this Catholic nun, why is there so much hurting in this? Why is this world so dark and cold? She told this Catholic nun. And the nun told her, I don't know. You know, and that lady died in her arms. But I remember that statement had an impact on me. And I thought, no, there's got to be something else. I got to help women. So I came back to Saskatchewan. I went into Canadian Bible College at the Orr Center. I stayed there. I had a vision before I came to Regina that I was living in this big house in Regina. So I knew that my path was being opened back to Regina. So I came back to Regina, went to Bible college, and then formed the Women of the Dawn. Now, there was only non-Aboriginal women that helped me. There was Claire Kramer from Kramer Tractors. There was Chief Justice Beda, Lorraine Bethel, a lot of the very influential women in Regina that assisted me. Because at that time, there was no women's Aboriginal women's organization. So the mandate was to get the women off the welfare system and make them self-reliant, where they wouldn't have to be dependent on the welfare system. And, you know, to go stand in the line for welfare is $195 a month. And then they pay your rent and utilities. But $195, you know, I explained to the women, like, what is that? You can't even buy your clothes. You can't buy transportation. You can't fly to Jamaica or Africa. You can't go nowhere. So try and get educated and get off the welfare system and then be independent. So from there, we trained over 500 women, going on to 600 women on computer skills and life skills training program. Again, along with the non-Aboriginal woman, we opened up the first training program at the Regina District Food Bank, and we got funding from the government, and we trained 20 women at a time, and we got them placed in positions such as the Casino Regina, INAC, all over provincial government. The success was 80% success rate, getting them long-term employment. So we have some very successful people. We have one girl, her name is Shantae, working at Casino Regina as the floor manager. She went from there to an Indian casino in Alberta, making $70,000 a year tax-free. We have another gentleman at INAC working in computers, making $60,000 a year tax-free from those training programs. So I guess the reason for that is to get them off the welfare system, and I always stress the importance of not being on welfare. And at times there's a need for children because you need to have some kind of support for them. So my mother raised us on welfare, but we also had gardens. We also went to the Tobin Lake up north, fished and, you know, stored up our food in deep freezes. So my mother taught us how to survive. But in today's society, like 1993, that was our mandate to get women off the welfare system. So that's why Women of the Dawn was founded. And to date, we've done that. We're successful. We do the First Nations Awards ceremony every year, and where we recognize First Nation people in all 14 different categories. And in 1990, we mostly had teachers and social workers from the university. Now we have all kinds of different kinds of graduates in science and technology. We have doctors, we have lawyers, we have teachers, social workers, nurses. We've come a long way in the last 30 years. But at that time, when I first came to Regina, there was hardly any Aboriginal graduates. So we've come a long way. But in Regina, and in regards to poverty and the needs are still there. We have a Christmas party every year. This is our 17th year. And this year, St. Mary's and St. Paul's Anglican Church come on board, and they give the gifts for the Aboriginal children, and we do the Christmas party. And my husband's involved with that the second year, and we're doing, it's hard though, it was very stressful. My husband says, you don't get a paycheck, and I kind of smile at myself, I don't get a paycheck. So he's providing for me, and I went through another traumatic experience, but I'll just close with this one, because I don't want to, get you all bored, but I had this vision about this tornado. Big, terrible tornado, and my younger son was in a dream, and I was looking out of this tent, looking at this tornado was raging and storming, and then I said, oh my God, what is that? Because tornado means trouble, some kind of trouble in your life. And then, so I went to Jamaica, I met my future husband, and didn't know he was going to be my husband because he was a Rasta. I don't know if you know what a Rasta is. They have long braids and all that kind of stuff. He doesn't have long braids today. But anyway, I go, there's no way I'm going to marry that kind of guy. And he's sitting there. But anyway, this is kind of funny. But I didn't marry him yet. Came back to Canada, and my older son got into major trouble. And I went to court for him, and I had a heart attack. Ended up in Calgary Foothills Hospital, and they put a stent in my heart in one of my arteries, and I was in intensive care, and he calls me and asks me, how are you okay? And I go, no, I'm in intensive care, I'm dying. It was so funny because, when you're sick, you want so much attention, right? I have a large extended family. When I'm going down into the emergency, into the intensive unit, nobody was there except one guys from my church, but my other son was there, and he's into UFC. He has his own shop on, it's called Complete Care, whatever. He's into UFC, has his own training program and everything. And he's looking down at me. He says, son, don't leave me, please, because I'm very sick. And he said, Mom, you're strong. Look at you. Look, you made me strong. Mom, you're strong. No, I'm not. Don't leave me, please. But anyway, the story short, I went through that traumatic experience. And I remember that dream that I had and knew that I was going to go through a bad time. And I came through it and still standing here. I have a stent in my heart, still another blocked artery, but my mission is not done yet. My husband said my mission is not done. And so until then, when it's over with, then I know that, I've done what I've been called to do. So in short, I want to thank you for letting me come and speak to you. We had sent out 60 letters to all the churches in Regina, this church, this Unitarian Fellowship, and the Archdiocese of Regina were the only two that responded to our request. So I want to thank you. So it was meant for us to be here this morning with my husband and I, and I thank Helen for coming to visit us. I enjoyed her, and I hope we'll be friends forever. And I really enjoyed being here, and I thank you so much. And I know that we have love for one another. I could feel that love when I came in here. You know, it's not, you don't have to be in a big religious institution to feel love. You know, you can show love every day, and I believe that's the whole basis of life, is to love one another and to share and to have that social responsibility that you have. And I feel that it's only in our hearts that God looks at. He doesn't look at the outward appearance or our bad attitude or whatever. He looks at our hearts. So thank you. And I'm open for questions.
Ivy, I'm going to take this out of here, there, and I'll take this around to invite people to ask questions, and then you'll be able to respond from your microphone. That was really wonderful. Thanks so much for sharing with us.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Joanne, and I wish we could have responded with cash as well, and maybe we still will. No promises one way or the other at the moment, but what I wondered about was you've mentioned some of the women of the community that have helped you get these programs started. Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of people who are doing the training and so on, do you feel like it's important for those people to be First Nations as well, so that there's sort of an example, I guess, to the people coming to the training? How important do you think that is?
Well, at the beginning, when we used to do, not now. I don't feel it's important to have all First Nations people now in today's society. At the beginning, like 30-some years ago, it was important for us to have Aboriginal people in leadership positions for our youth to see that there's hope that they could be a Aboriginal counselor. Because I co-founded an Aboriginal youth facility. It's called Tapawichi. It's right behind the Rosemont Shopping Center. And we got Aboriginal boys in there. And it's been in operation for 30 years, and it's still in operation. We felt that in order for our Aboriginal youth to see our people in leadership roles, we hired all Aboriginal, you know, youth counselors, so they can see that they could be youth counselors, but not today. I feel that we hired non-Aboriginal people in our training programs because at that time there wasn't educated computer skills trainers or teachers or... I don't feel that we have to have all Aboriginal. No, not in today's society, because if I had all Aboriginal teachers, I don't know if I'd be still stable today. You know, we need to adjust into today's society, and coming off the reservation, we need to work together. And I feel that non-Aboriginal people, if they didn't help me, I wouldn't have been so successful in the programs that I have in Regina. We have a housing complex built behind Jolly Rogers that we had got for Aboriginal women. It's not for Aboriginal women now. It's through Regina Housing for low rental, for housing for women. But no, not anymore. I don't advocate for that anymore. I like to work with all kinds of people.
Yeah. Thank you, Ivy. My question is regarding giving forward. You mentioned two successful stories of a man and a woman who now in Calgary, wherever they are. Do you have anybody that you know, basically, that are being helped by the program that now are successful and giving back forward, meaning that either they build their own programs to help other First Nation Aboriginal women, or coming back to your organization and say, let me give you forward?
Yeah, we have I have a middle son. His name is Anthony Scales, AJ Scales. He was washing cars at the time when I asked him. I said, are you tired of washing cars now, son? He said, yes, I am. Well, come into our training program. And he came into their training program at a grade 12. We put him to INAC, Indian Northern Affairs. He's still there. He's been working there for 15 years. He founded his own, jiu-jitsu company, jiu-jitsu. And he came back and he helped us with our First Nations Awards. He was helping us through the years, and he, you know, he put back what he received from us into our organization, not financially, but his experience, like with iTech and all that kind of stuff. But so successful. I don't even hardly see him anymore. I have to watch UFC on TV to be able to even kind of think about my son. He was in the paper 2 weeks ago, second page. Yeah, but there's other people that went through the training program, came back and helped us. And but I can't use every, you know how many people have helped us through that organization through 20 years? So many people, different kinds of people come in and help us. I hope I answered your question, Bruno. Did I? Okay, thank you.
I just want to ask you, has it been any help since we've had our First Nations University here? And as far as training programs go, have you been able to get people more involved in that?
Pardon?
With our First Nations University?
Yes.
Has that been helpful?
Oh.
Getting people, getting them trained and educated and
so forth?
Oh,
yes, yes, definitely. The First Nations University made a great impact on our students. When they first opened up the doors, like a lot of times people have, First Nations people would come into Regina and have that culture shock right from the reservation. So in order to have a First Nations University and being able to step into doors where they feel comfortable, at least for a couple of years, and then graduate, yeah, that's helpful. I feel that. Because when I came to Regina at the age of 8, I had culture shock. And if I didn't adjust to society, you know, I wouldn't have made it this far. You know, so there's a migration of our people coming into the cities, and sometimes they can't adjust. And then they fall into the trap of alcoholism and drug addiction and all kinds of lifestyle. And sometimes they don't finish their education, and then they're lost, right? So if they come from the First Nation, the reservations, come to the university in Regina, start getting used to society and the larger society, and then they can eventually adjust into jobs. Yeah, it helps us. It helps the First Nations people, because there they see First Nations teachers and they're able to feel comfortable. But just to be plucked into a larger society without any, you know, any experience, then they all have difficulty. So it does help us. And now that with the First Nations University now more sound within the larger university, I believe it's going to be there for a longer time. Yeah. That's on my only belief.
Ivy, I'd like to just comment on the second comment. You were talking about the importance of having non-Aboriginal people working with Aboriginal people. Yes. At about the time when you started Women of the Dawn, I was working in a program called Bridging Program for Women. I don't know if you remember.
Yes, I remember that.
And in any class of 20 that I had, I would usually have 2 or 3 Aboriginal women.
Yes.
And I think that it was valuable not only for those Aboriginal women, it was very valuable for everybody else to have those Aboriginal women in those classes.
Yes.
Because there were many women in those groups who had never, ever had a chance to talk to an Aboriginal woman, who had never sort of had a sense of the humanity.
Right.
And certainly not of the incredible barriers and difficulties that many of those women were facing. I mean, for many of them, just to get in the door every day and to come every day was a huge achievement.
Right.
And I learned a huge amount about the difficulties and problems that they were facing, and about their courage.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it educated a lot of the white women by being exposed to the Native women. I'm not going to minimize the importance of the First Nations University or of programs that are specifically for Aboriginal women or Aboriginal men, but I think it's also important that there be mixed programs so that we can be educated as well.
Exactly. I believe that. I didn't go into the larger areas of issues that we have, like the drugs and the gang issues that we have now. I didn't want to go into all that because I didn't have enough time. But we do have a lot of gang issues, and we do have a lot of Aboriginal women living in poverty. And it's the Aboriginal women, it's the women that are taking the leading, they're taking the lead in our families and in our culture. It's the Aboriginal women that are the backbone of our society, where we have to provide now, because their men are not doing their jobs. They're either in the correctional centers, a lot of them are, and they're coming out of the jails, and they just don't go to work. And my husband already realizes that, coming from a third world country, Jamaica, coming into Regina, where there's services for people, and there's jobs galore. And they say, why aren't those big men working, you know? But the big men that are hanging around have alcohol problems, and I can't, you know, can't support them by saying, well, they have alcohol problems, you know what I mean? But it stems right back to their families. You know, you can't blame all the time, like that person all the time, because the way you raise your children, this is my own opinion, it's how you raise your child. You know, if they see your mother going to work, you see your mom being in a position that, well, that child's going to want to be like that mother, right? And my mother was a hard worker. She raised five of us or six of us, and all of us were working people, except one. One turned out, you know, to be a drug addict, and she's still a drug addict today. You know, it's how we were raised, I feel, and how we parent our children, because a lot of our Aboriginal women have alcohol and drug problems, and they come from the residential schools. They don't know how to participate in other programs, and it's hard for them to adjust. How time management? How do they come? They have to learn how to come to work on time. You don't come to work at 9:10 or 9:15. Time is so important. So there was this, when we started our training programs off at the food bank, we had this another program in New York where they were training the black people how to be at work on time. So our training program said you have to be at the training program on time at 9 o'clock, right? But anyway, it can go on forever.
We'll take just one more quick question.
Great question.
Thank you for coming to talk to us, Ivy. It's just wonderful to hear you. You mentioned training programs many times, but I'd like to know just what goes on in the training programs when someone walks in your door. What do you put them into teach them?
Okay, we usually have a nine-month program. 9 months, because what we looked at is getting funding from the First Nations reservations to be able to complement their training allowance. So the vans won't pay for any training program less than 9 months. So we'd go for 9 months. So the first month would be life skills, how to come to work on time, how to shake hands, how to be able to greet each other in the class setting, in the workforce, how to dress, how to have eye contact, how when you're going in, how to be interviewed, how not to, you know, put your head down, because a lot of our culture, our values is to, you know, to have respect for our people. In our culture, we weren't supposed to speak to our father-in-law or even speak back to our mothers and our fathers and all that. We were very humble people. And sometimes, like I was taught, if you don't look me in the eye, there's something about you, you're shady, right? That's in the larger society. But in our culture, we had to not look at our grandfather in the eye. We had to be humble. So we had to teach them now how to have eye contact, how to have a firm handshake. Like, you don't just have a little wimpy handshake, because some people feel, well, that's not very, you know, very nice, right? So we had to do the life skills of first month. The next 3 months was computer training. And then if they had to do their grade 12 education, then we tried to help them with their grade 12. And then after the next 2 months, they go on work placement. We put them in Casino Regina or INAC or the provincial government, where they got job placement, where they got training. So that's what we did with them. And then time management was very important at the beginning, and we kept attendance of all the students. And then, like I said, it was 80% successful, so the majority of them had jobs. We have a court worker that's working at the provincial courthouse right now in the courtroom. Her name is Tracy Digerly. She's been there for 12 years, too. Yeah, so a lot of good successes.
Thank you so much, Ivy. It's really important for us to hear about people like you who are doing such wonderful work in our community. I want to read one little piece here. Because I'm really I'm a newly retired person, wondering what I ought to be doing personally in the community and not just sure. I appreciated Joanne's question about, is it okay to volunteer in Aboriginal settings? Is that all right? But I want to read this quick reading before we move on to 502. So if you want to check in your books. But in an Aboriginal context, Adrian Rich's words really touch me. And I think it shows what you've done, and it's my way of saying thank you to you. My heart is moved by all I cannot save. So much has been destroyed. I have to cast my lot with those like you who age after age perversely and with no extraordinary power reconstitute the world. Now that's really what you're doing, Ivy, so thank you so much.
Oh, thank you very much.
We appreciate your coming this morning.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Good.
Thank you.